This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Your first time here. Me too, my first time. Well, thank you for coming up the mountain today. I don't know what brought you. I don't know what brought me either. But it's a pleasure, really, to share this practice with you, and here, especially Jikoji. It's a very special place. You maybe already had a taste of that. I'm very happy to introduce you to our friend David Kalili. He is a psychotherapist, and he's going to give a reflection on practice. Any of you can give a reflection on your practice if you'd like to do this someday. But he has an amazing point of view to share in a Buddhist temple, and it's unusual. We don't actually indulge ourselves, really, with outside of the Buddha's teachings very often, but there's nothing not included in the Buddha's teachings, and it's good for us to remember that and explore the vast range of teachings. Everything that the Buddha had said is contained here, and everything he says is contained within the Buddha's teaching, if your mind is ready to receive it. So David is a licensed marriage and family therapist, board certified sexologist, I love to say that in a Zendo, and founder of Rouse Relational Wellness, a boutique couples and sex therapy center in San Francisco. He authored the recently published Mental Health Workbook for Men to enhance men's relationships with themselves and others. If you'd like to peruse that book, I pulled it out of the bookshelf. It's up in the community room where we'll be having lunch. David aims to help men feel less lonely and more connected with communities. Specializing in couples and sex therapy, David draws from his own diverse background, which includes peer sex education, work in adult boutiques, and a master's degree in sexuality studies from San Francisco State University. Thank you, David, for joining us today and for sharing your teachings.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. It's an honor to be introduced by you, so thank you so much. I want to start with a poem that is in my home and is also in the waiting room at my office, and was actually just recently published on I don't know what the proper term is, but a brochure that's sent out when someone dies. It's not a brochure. What's that? A pamphlet. My great uncle passed away about a couple of months ago, lived to the ripe age of 97, and when they sent out the announcement, this was the poem on the back, and it's just been a poem that's been really resonating with me as well, and it's by Rumi, who is also someone that I named my kid after. It's called The Guest House. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house and empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So I wanted to discuss patterns today. And they're going to be patterns in relationships and patterns in how you show up. But I want to remind you that these are just patterns, and they can change and they can shift. And just like we ourselves are a guest house to emotions and to experiences, this talk is going to be a guest house to different ideas, different concepts, different connections. So I encourage you to chew on it, take it in, but you don't have to get attached to these ideas or concepts. Just want to help a little bit, give some insight into how we're showing up in relationships. So I'm going to share a little story, and this will highlight some aspects of attachment styles and trauma responses, which is what I'm going to be talking about today, and how they interact and how they show up in relationships, and then we'll do a little practice. So Aisha and Michael are a new couple in their 30s in the Bay Area. Aisha is in her 30s. She immigrated from Lebanon with her family as a kid. And her family leans more stoic due to a variety of reasons. Because of her lived experience as a woman, but also the trauma that she experienced in Lebanon during the Civil War, she experiences others as wanting something from her. Every compliment, every request, every question has something tied to it. And understandably so, given her experiences. Michael is a white American man. His family has been in America for generations. He has the privileges of a white man, but he also has a lot of insecurities that he's not meeting the standards of what's supposed to be this male ideal that's been kind of given to him. One night they're at a casual restaurant and they're talking, and with no preamble or lead up, Michael throws out the idea of moving in together. And Aisha, who likes her space and her routines, freezes up at this idea, and he sees the freezing and he panics at this, and he goes into anxiety and he fills in her freezing with his own insecurities, and he starts to fawn and praise her and say, wouldn't this be amazing? This would be a great relationship. We can move in, we can have kids. And she goes to ambivalence because she just wants some time to think about it, and she says something ambiguous like, can we think about it a little bit? Maybe in 6 months when I'm done with school. And he responds to her ambivalence with more panic, but this time anger. And he responds to her with all or nothings, maybe listing all the nice things that he's done for her, maybe telling her how he'll make sure that this will be a nice space for her. And then they don't have a really nice night, and they'll talk the next day. So this exchange kind of captures how their different trauma responses and attachment styles can interact with one another. Her need and desire for independence and space, and his need for closeness and reassurance can create quite a cycle of conflict. And this is super common. There's many names for this type of dance. There's the pursuer-withdrawer dance. And I want to normalize that all of the trauma responses and the attachment styles that I'm talking about, I've experienced each one of them. So this is all normal. It doesn't make you a bad person if you've experienced either of these. So with attachment styles, so attachment style was started mostly discussed by John Bowlby and Dr. Mary Ainsworth, where they discuss, the way I put it is, it's your flavor of connection. How do you connect to people? How close do you like to be to people? How close do you like your relationships to be? Or how much distance do you want? And this is based on early childhood experiences or early romantic relationships. So essentially, how was love and attention given in your early childhood or in your early relationships? Was it freely given and was it consistent? Or was it sporadic and conditional? Probably somewhere in between. There's secure attachment style. Because of my line of work, I don't really see many securely attached people, but I treat them like a museum piece. I'm very interested and I wonder what's going on. I'm very curious and I want to talk to their parents and see what they did. But they're very grounded. I don't want to make them also sound like they're, this enlightened. They also have work to do. But they don't go to existential crisis when there's a problem in the relationship. They don't seek validation. They're comfortable with closeness. They're just very kind of grounded in it, in a way. They can regulate and they can engage in a conflict and then get some space and boundaries when they need to. Anxious, preoccupied folks. Those are folks who, in early attachment or early childhood experiences, the love and caregiving was not very consistent. And so they couldn't rely on it in a lot of ways. And the way that they've adapted to that, and this can be conscious, but usually it's not usually it's unconscious. The way they've adapted to that is to seek for reassurance. They're either pulling for it or they're looking for signals of reassurance. But sometimes they won't believe that reassurance, or they'll have a hard time really letting it sit with them. And so they'll be seeking further reassurance. The avoidant folks, they tend to like independence, self-sufficiency, conflict and closeness can be overwhelming. And so their strategy is more of just kind of do their own thing, stay in their own space. And disorganized folks come from a more abusive or...
It's a cat.
I love it.
Is anybody here allergic to cats?
Oh, to the cat commit?
Yeah.
Yay!
Sweet.
You sure? No allergies. Excuse me.
Yay! That's so cool.
Okay, we're never doing this again.
And
don't tell me.
Doesn't want coming.
Oh, right, yeah, now they're late.
Is that Teresa's cat? Is she gone?
I'm sorry.
No, she came up to me earlier. And disorganized attachment, that's usually as a result of, unfortunately, being in an abusive household growing up. And so it's very unpredictable, very chaotic. There can be some love, some violence, some neglect. And people who have a disorganized style can seek connection and reassurance, but also push away from it when it gets too close. And they're confused by it as well. It's not something that they're choosing or they're deciding on. It's more of a trauma reaction. And then with trauma responses, there's fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. And so with fight, that's getting aggressive, that's pushing forward. Like Michael was getting aggressive and saying, you know, why aren't you saying yes to my great offer to move in with me? Flight is pulling away or running away. This can be physical or emotional. Freeze is shutting down or maybe even dissociating. And fawn is people pleasing. It's just kind of praising. It's the idea that if you just kind of like appease the threat, then they won't hurt you. Maybe I'll give her, she doesn't seem like a threat. Okay, bad example. And so we all have these trauma responses. This is the nature of our nervous systems. But those who have experienced trauma in their early childhood, early relationships, or even recently, are gonna have some sort of kind of amplification of these trauma responses. And so if you remember that these are very much connected to and rooted in our nervous systems, ways to work through this is through some breath work, either box breathing, where you breathe in for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds, and hold for 4 seconds. Timeouts work. So if you and a partner or a caregiver are going through it, doing a little 20-minute timeout actually does you some good. It takes about 20 minutes for our nervous systems to reset. I really like, obviously, journaling, handwriting your thoughts and processing, but it also depends on your processing style and your comfort to closeness. So are you someone that is more of a verbal processor and you like to be alone journaling? Are you a verbal processor and like closeness, go on a nice walk? But I also very much follow what Carl Jung talks about, which is, you know, one of the main ways to express and process emotions is through creativity. And so painting, sculpture, whatever it may be. And so the Buddha, of course, discusses attachment and talks about how attachment to people, possessions, or ideas can lead to suffering or dukkha. If you like dark humor, there's a podcast called Daily Affirmations with Bob Dukkha. It's very funny. It's only like 10 minutes long, and it's got a nice dark sense of humor to it. But instead of becoming attached, he encourages appreciating relationships without becoming overly dependent or entangled. A small example that I've seen of this in my work with relationships is I encourage people to not treat breakups as failures. Oftentimes people will when they're, especially when they're in the middle of it, and of course it's devastating, or it can be, they're treating it as a failure and that they've lost all these years to this relationship, when in reality, maybe you've gotten some lessons learned, maybe you've learned about yourself, but at the very least you've had these experiences in your life and with this person that you can take with you and is not a waste or a failure. And so the way that these show up together is with a secure person. They're usually stable in conflict, like I said. They can stay calm, they can stay grounded, they can sit through the conflict, they can see it through. Anxious folks, they typically fight or they fawn. So you saw Michael, they go to fawn first, typically, where they'll try to praise or appease. And when that doesn't work, they can go to anger or shutdown. I got the amazing chance of meeting Esther Perel on Thursday night. And she talked about with the fawning piece that when you're fawning to someone and you're just giving them lots of praise and reassurance and love, maybe even love bombing, you're entering in this, let's see if I can remember how she put it. You're entering into an unspoken contract with the other person that this person has not even agreed to, that they will give you something in response for the niceness. And when they break that contract, which they will because they don't know that they've entered into this, you're gonna get frustrated or upset, and it's gonna lead to resentment. Or another way to put it, Anne Lamont talks about uncommunicated expectations are resentments under construction. So if you can, to the best of your ability, first thing you gotta do is understand what your expectations are. It's a lot of work to do because it's also a lot of imprinting and programming and influence from your childhood experiences, your culture, your religion, messages that you've received based on your different social identities. But it can be really helpful to flesh out, okay, what am I expecting in relationships and what do I think I should be getting? Avoidant folks go to fight, flight or freeze. And this can look like I said, physical distance or emotional distance, which is freezing or stonewalling. And then disorganized is a nice little mix of all of the above. Can be lashing out, which is fighting, and then silence, or retreating, which is freeze, and then trying to appease, which is fawn. And the person who has the disorganized attachment and their partner certainly are pretty confused as to what's happening and how to get through it. So I've been talking a lot about these shifting emotions that we can experience and these shifting physical sensations that we can experience. And so I want to do a little practice for us to, the best of our ability, see what this is like when we're shifting our emotions. So if you'd like, you don't have to, you can join me. And close your eyes or a soft gaze. And for now, we're just going to find a call up internally, a neutral space, something that is soothing or relaxing. Just take a couple of deep breaths and try to call it up. Two-pronged approach. One of it is in the moment experience to kind of tap into the good moments. Rick Hansen from UC Berkeley, who writes wonderfully about resiliency and talks about soaking in the good moments. And when I led a retreat here in April and we went to the sunset hike at the Ridgeline, and I told everyone, all right, soak it in. This is your good experience. And you like soak in the air and just the memory. And when I checked in with them a month later, a lot of them talked about how that was a memory that really they could recall. Mm-hmm. So in those good moments when they're stressed out with work or in an argument, they can kind of recall this positive memory. The other aspect of this exercise is to help you understand, not just you, but you, understand the feeling and experience what it's like to go in that pendulum of emotions. Because sometimes, especially with anxiety or trauma, it can be really convincing that it's there and it's there to stay. And to have this experience that our emotions are going to surf and they're going to go up and down and crest and come dip back down again can be a really reassuring experience for those who have anxiety. And also in the moment when you're in an argument with your partner and it's feeling very convincing that you got to figure it out right now, or that you got to get the hell, sorry, you got to get away. You can do these exercises to get some distance and some space to consider what to do next. In most relationships, in most times, unless there's abuse or there's significant trauma, you don't need to make a decision right away. What are some initial What are some initial... Yeah, yeah, please.
I was just going to say that for me, it's the unknowing that's the anxiety. So let's say you get a diagnosis that you have breast cancer, mm-hmm. and then you have to wait mm-hmm. to see if your insurance is going to cover it. So you have all these months before you get scheduled for surgery, before you can even go in. So that's an unknown, stressful.
Yeah.
The other one is when you get a letter in the mail from the IRS, and you don't want to open it. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh no. For me, a neutral place is I'm a gardener. So I just like, I volunteer everywhere. And I just lose myself in somebody else's weeds, so to speak. So I suppose a neutral place and a happy place is picking flowers. Mm-hmm. So, and then sometimes, you know, you're like really on a high and you think, okay, the only place to go is down.
Right.
And so then you start to think, okay, well, maybe I could just level off. And so that's when I come down to meditation. Uh-huh. Helps me a lot. So thank you for this. This is
cool. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. Yeah, I can feel the anxiety rise in me when you gave those two examples. The diagnosis and waiting for insurance. I've gone through that with family members. And then the IRS, yeah. Absolutely. What is going to happen now? What are people's initial reactions to either learning today or learning in the past about attachment styles and how they show up in relationships?
Well, I do often wonder in psychology about these categories. How useful it is to put someone into a category versus keeping it as an open spectrum.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. Yeah, one of the things that I try to say but often forget is that we may have like a base attachment style, but we also have, it's a spectrum and it changes over time. And there's lovely research, both in terms of kind of interviewing people over time, but also brain scans to show the different wiring that can be happening over long-term positive attachment relationships. And the way that I can, the way that I see this as being helpful is it's a good labeling or categorizing of what you're experiencing in the moment so that you have an idea of how to navigate it or how to sit with it. But I don't, I don't want people to identify as I'm an anxiously attached person, and then therefore this will always be kind of my lot in life, and this is what I'm always going to, how my reactions are going to be. You're going to have a different reaction or different attachment style to a long-term partner than you would to a new job, or to a new friend, or to a long-term partner who's pulling away for whatever reason. But yeah, I definitely agree with that. I can feel like some of the ways that psychological concepts can put people in a box doesn't really do any good.
I have a question of whether or not you see in your practice, or it's documented, that certain attachment styles go together. Like, I was wondering about the obvious, anxious and avoidant.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, and, you know, there's a concept that I really like. It's just, it also has a poetic name. It's interlocking vulnerabilities. And, like, that's a really good example where your vulnerabilities are just hook into each other. And the goal or the idea is for you to find out, okay, what are those hooks? And why have we hooked into each other so well? What are we trying to accomplish, or what are we trying to treat? Esther Perel talks about how if you're entering every conversation with a partner with the idea that you're either going to be right or wrong in the end, you're asking for a lot of conflict and a lot of strife in your relationship. But if you can sit with the discomfort of their emotions, their experiences, your experiences, their views of you, even if they're not right, if you can sit with that for a moment, you can really help them process and yourself process what's going through. You know, some people who have more of an anxious style will go right to apologizing or fawning as a way to just take care of the conflict and make it go away. And then but what ends up happening is even if that abdicates their own needs or puts aside their own needs just for the sake of saying, okay, we're good, we're connected. But the unmet needs are still there, the conflict's still there, the unresolved aspects are still there. And so it's going to pop up later. Given that we're in the Bay Area, and I don't know who's dating out here, who's playing with the apps, but how have you seen kind of the tech-driven culture in the Bay Area impact how we're showing up in relationships? How many days do you have? Yeah. Frightening, you said?
Yeah. Mm. I don't date. Mm. But I see my friends, you know, in conflict a lot, showing up with people that they just meet for the first time, for the unknown, because a lot of times those sites, they're not truthful.
Mm-hmm.
And so they show up and the person they thought they were going to meet isn't at all what it said on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And trusting.
Yeah.
But that's just my experience being 65.
True.
And widowed.
Sure. Or just how do you see as kind of the culture, the tech-driven culture that we're in right now, impacting how we show up in relationships or how we show up in dating? Yeah.
I feel like now the way that we see.
I like the value piece that you mentioned, how that translates to the relationships. Thank you.
Nowadays have access to the apps, they can easily connect with anyone. And with
desire to optimize, get the best person, the best partner, show up in the best way, become the best person yourself. As much as I talk about self-help and improving ourselves, I also warn people that self-help can be self-harm. At some point, we just have to accept the good enough and not try to like constantly tweak. Yeah.
Yeah, initially I had
The breaking up because of dissatisfaction. The other end of it is the romantic stories of the 40s and 50s of the relationship, the marriages that lasted 60 years. Well, longevity is not really successful, or not a key of success, right? Those relationships had their own issues. There was abuse. The women couldn't have bank accounts until the 70s, maybe. So there's lots of reasons why just because they're together for a long time doesn't mean that it's a successful thing. But trying to find the best or the brightest is also not the answer. How do you think, or can you think of a recent conflict where understanding your trauma response or attachment style could have been useful, or maybe you were thinking of it in the moment? And it was helpful. Yeah.
I would say that the unspoken contract, the role, uncomfortable about that balance and the things they give up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a balance, right? Where it is good to be able to be clear and communicate our expectations, but it can be really exhausting to have to tell your partner all of your expectations, all of your desires, all of your needs. My wife and I met bartending together. And she and I both have a lot of experience in the restaurant industry. And when we host dinner parties or just cleaning up around the house, and we have a 3-year-old, and so there's a lot of cleaning up around the house. I've just noticed that we have a good rhythm and we have a good just kind of dance together. And we just kind of pick up where the other person left off. And there's not this need to say, okay, you do this or you do that. Other aspects of our life, we have to be very clear. Like parenting is new to us. And so we have to be very clear. Okay, this is your shift. Or okay, I'll take over now. Don't worry, this or that. And so finding that balance in your relationship where what does feel good to you to be more clear about.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So the Buddha taught, know the causes and conditions of your suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Know the causes and conditions of your joy. Your exercise was like a beautiful example of this teaching. And I'm just wondering if you know, if you when you're describing these attachment styles, if you, maybe everyone here had that, oops, that's me, moment. I got my number. So let's say you acknowledge and accept and receive that truth.
Uh-huh.
And in a moment of discomfort and awareness of, oh, this is, you know, I'm reacting out of this place.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to your bathtub, maybe,
mm-hmm.
or the hike, or wherever your neutral place is, or you go for a walk, or you get yourself calm. I understand getting the nervous system to kind of like,
mm-hmm.
okay. But you might have some pretty deep habit energy
yeah.
here, right?
Yeah.
And this is what we look at when we face this wall, mm-hmm. our habit energy. How do you work with your awareness of your attachment
mm-hmm.
style?
Think of patience, as you mentioned, so acknowledging that it's from many years and many repeated experiences that you've developed these habits, and so it's going to take some time and repeated experiences to undo those habits. And so patience and self-compassion. There's the work of internal family systems, where it looks at yourself as different parts, so we're not just a monolith of one human. We're made up of very different parts, and those parts were influenced from different experiences, different traumas, different influences. And so to acknowledge yourself as, it helps with shame. It helps with the idea that we can make adjustments and change. And so the times that I have showed up in embarrassing ways in relationships that I don't want on my highlight reel at my funeral, I have to remind myself when I get that little gut punch, when I remember, it's like, okay, that was in the past. That may show up again in the future, but I am working on it in a way. So like acknowledging what you're doing along the way can be really helpful as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's just, thank you.
Avoidance.
Oh, how do they get along when they recognize the preoccupied and avoidant dance? Yeah, I think being able to recognize that it is a dance, being able to like notice and experience the pattern enough time where they can say, oh, okay, the last 5 times this has happened, my partner will take a break for about an hour or two, and then they'll come back to me with an offering of this, that, or the other, and then they'll open up and talk about. And so like if you can start to notice the pattern that's showing up in your dance, that can make it less existentially scary. Because the fear in that moment of the conflict is, one is that we're going to break up in any moment, or we're not right for each other, or we're not going to make this work, or we're going to do this over and over and over again. Or the frustration of, I got stuff to do, and now we're arguing about this, and I'm really busy and stressed out, and so I have to put more attention into this. And so having that patience of understanding the patterns that will show up can be helpful. Couples therapy can be useful, and then labeling the different trauma reactions that you're having in that moment. But it's not easy, and it, like a lot of these things are simple in the way that they look, but really difficult in how they feel and how they show up. And so there's some of these things can be like a 3-step process, but can take decades or years to accomplish because it's just this constant repetition and reminder. And working with your nervous system, which is a powerful force.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.